Welcome. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show, and today I'm pleased to have on Dr. Tom Harbin, the author of Waking Up Blind, Lawsuits Over Eye Surgery, the shocking story of blinded eyes and the hospital politics that allowed it. Well, welcome, Dr. Harbin. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Where are you calling in from today?
Atlanta.
Atlanta. Well, we're both in Atlanta. That's great. I enjoyed the book tremendously. I think it's something that many doctors know about, that if they bring up problems within the hospital or the institution, that they are likely to be targeted themselves. I think there's been many instances of this, but I guess this is your first book. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's not first.
Well, you've done a great job of making it very, very entertaining. When we're trained in medicine, it's not always easy to present material in a way that isn't dry and kind of over left brain. But your book is extremely easy to read and brings out very, very important information that I think the public needs to know. Would you like to introduce yourself a little bit about your background and your training and how you became aware of what you're speaking about in the book?
Okay. I'm an ophthalmologist. I've been practicing in Atlanta for 35 years. I did my residency, my eye training at Johns Hopkins, the Wilmer Eye Institute, where I met the central character of this book, and came to Atlanta where I joined Eye Consultants of Atlanta, and he came a couple of years later to be the chairman of the department. I was teaching on the clinical faculty, meaning I went down to Grady, the teaching hospital, every couple of weeks for an afternoon, and came to the conferences and got to know the people about which I wrote, and heard about some of these affairs, and ended up seeing the patient who had his wrong eye operated to perform an independent medical evaluation for the lawyer who had sued. And so I knew about these events to some degree, but when it came time for me to write about them and I looked into all the facts, I realized I knew just about 10% of what really happened, and it took digging and reading depositions and transcripts to come up with the whole story.
Yeah, I was impressed with the list of letters, deposition information, and even peer review information and review from ethics committees as well, so society ethics committees and medical boards. So it's just a vast amount of material that you've gathered together. And I think you've done a very good job talking about how politics enters almost any, I would imagine, almost any human endeavor, certainly. I also went to Hopkins undergrad, and then I ended up being in the military for 13 years, and certainly politics had a role there as well. It's almost whenever humans gather, we have political considerations that often outweigh the truth, which is very interesting.
About that.
So let's talk a little bit about the events that you describe in the book, just kind of a brief outline so the listeners understand what the book's about, and we can go on from there.
Okay. When this man, about the central character who was the chairman of the department, became the chairman, he began a series of activities that, on one hand, were very good for Emory. He raised a lot of money. He greatly expanded the faculty. He raised the money for the I building, which they currently inhabit. But he got very, very busy, and he began operating on eyes that really didn't have any disease. And some of these eyes went blind from complications that are natural to any operation. Some of these eyes went blind from undiagnosed post-operative glaucoma, i.e. the surgery went well, but there were problems afterwards that were not picked up. And a good friend of mine who was on the faculty, these things became known, and he began to point out the problems, and he was ignored. A new dean came. He heard about the problems, patients who'd driven 3 and 4 hours to see this doctor and were given about a 2 minutes worth of an examination and then put out the door. The dean ordered him to slow down, and he did not. And people warned that a disaster would happen at one point or another. And sure enough, one day, as busy as he was, he operated on the wrong eye of a patient. The patient had one good eye and one bad eye, and he operated on the good eye instead of the bad eye. And the man never regained sight. And in fact, after his second eye was operated on by this doctor, the undiagnosed post-operative glaucoma took away his sight, so he was totally blind. And word then got to him that when he had the wrong eye operated, the doctor lied to him and told him that he had actually changed his mind and had intended to operate on that eye, which was simply not true. So the lawyers got involved, lawsuits came. Emory had an ethics committee investigation that, amazingly enough, exonerated the chairman and reprimanded the doctor, who was a friend of mine, who was correctly and bravely speaking up about the problems. And then the press got a hold of it, and there ended up being 7 lawsuits. And finally, the American Academy of Ophthalmology conducted an examination which, by its ethics committee, which did find problems, and he had to resign and leave. That's the quick version of the book.
So, basically, in your opinion, the powers that be at Emory were protecting this man because of his ability to generate prestige as well as the outside money. I think it's important for the listeners to understand that when he generated all of these millions for the Eye Center, he did it through his own fundraising events. He didn't use Emory's money. So, therefore, he was very valuable to Emory. Would you say that was the main reason that this was...
I think that's true. He was raising money from private donors to build the Eye Center. But at the same time, he was an MD, PhD, and he was getting grants from the National Eye Institute and bringing in PhD researchers and greatly expanding the research capabilities of the department, mm-hmm. all of which is good. So they chose, for whatever reason, to pay more attention to what the good things he was doing and turned a blind eye, so to speak, to the other things.
Right. And in your follow-up of what happened to this main character later on, it seems to me that the academic community didn't seem to heed that he may have been dishonest and he may have been deliberately doing fraudulent billing and other changing medical records and some of the other things that were presented. And he just goes on to be employed elsewhere with very little, I guess, permanent damage to his reputation.
That is very true. The terms of his agreement with the American Academy was that he couldn't see patients for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
but he went to another institution, served out that 2-year sentence, so to speak, by doing research, and then he became very active in seeing patients and ended up going to another institution, and just recently was awarded the highest award that cornea doctors, and this was his subspecialty, can award to one of their own. So his career has flourished, whereas the 2 doctors who were the whistleblowers, so to speak, never recovered their academic career.
Right. So that's an interesting outcome. Do you believe that there exists within academia the potential for them to protect their own?
No question about it. I won't say that this happens everywhere, but it happens more than you'd like to think or see.
So, I'm obviously in clinical practice. I'm a plastic surgeon. And I have heard from many of my patients that they wouldn't think of having surgery at an academic institution. Now, I don't know whether, you know, that it's not the majority of my patients, but when people feel that way, they're very, very adamant about it. It may be because they don't want residents operating on them, or they don't want, you know, certain long waits and other things that are common in academic centers. But there is a small portion of the population, which is actually the more educated portion of the population, that stays away from academic institutions in terms of surgery. Have you encountered that? I know you've been both in academics and in private practice.
I think so. A lot of people don't like, as you say, the residents and fellows and all the trainees having a hand in their care and the inevitable delays. But my view of this is, if you have a bread-and-butter operation, say a hernia or a cataract operation that's done very well in the community and done more often by someone in the community, you're going to be better off having it done in that setting.
Right.
If you have an aneurysm in a certain place in your brain,
rare
thing, and there's somebody somewhere who does a bunch of these operations every year, you're going to be better off for that particular problem going to that type of doctor.
So yeah, I think that's true.
As to whether you're going to be helped or hurt by going somewhere. I don't mean hurt, but surgical volume helps expertise. And if you're
going
to somebody who does a lot of something, then you're going to have a lot better chance of a good result.
Yeah, this brings up another point that was brought up in the book, that when the patients are poor and possibly of a certain skin color, there ends up being differences in treatment that actually was noted by the PA and I guess failed to really be presented in the court cases, but was certainly the evidence was there that was happening.
Yes, I think it was more economic than racial. It just so happened that a lot of the poor people at that time were African American. But the Medicaid patients and the poorer patients were placed at the end of a long surgical day, in part so that the residents or the fellows could have the opportunity to operate on them, which is when they get to do things, but in part because this doctor wanted it that way. But what's worse is that he did a lot of corneal transplants, which involves tissue from the eye bank, and such tissue is graded as to how fresh and good it is. And he would always use the freshest tissue for the first few patients of the day, and he would rank order his patients by their economic status.
Right.
So the executives got done first by him with the best tissue, and at the end of the day, at the end of a long day, the poorer patients were done, sometimes by him and sometimes by the fellow or the resident, with less good tissue.
And sometimes up to 13 patients a day would be done, or probably even more, but there was many, many cases per day.
Yes.
Which is common in ophthalmology. It's just, you know,
ophthalmology cases are like a cataract, can be done in 10 or 15 minutes, and so
you
do a lot in a day. But he was doing corneal transplants, and those take a lot longer to do.
The average?
I would say they take at least 45 minutes. I don't do that.
So 13 of them with turnover is still a long day.
A very long day.
13 hours, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, interesting. So this occurred back in the 80s, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And Emory now has, obviously, you know, different people, probably even all the way up to the top, different people are involved with running it now. And, I mean, I think in the back of your book you list where everybody went. So Emory's faculty is entirely different now, including the president. And do you think that Emory has learned from this at all, or do you think things are done differently?
Well, you know, the book was published a little over a year ago, and by that time, Emory had changed, as has medicine, and there's a lot more attention being paid to wrong site surgery and to quality and to ethics.
Uh-huh.
Emory is a very different place, in large part because of what happened to most places.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is a much better place, no question about it. But I can't credit my book necessarily, because by a year ago, Emory was already a very different place.
Right.
So very well received. It's being used to teach ethics to residents at a number of institutions. I've gotten invitations to speak about ethics at 6 or 7 various universities around the country. So it's being received and being taught as a way of emphasizing ethics.
I'm aware of at least one lawsuit that actually became public, including the amounts awarded, when a VA Emory physician who was a pulmonologist blew the whistle and subsequently was fired, or I don't know the exact details. I assume he was fired, and then he countersued for that and won a settlement. So, and I'm not sure exactly when that was, but this kind of thing can happen frequently. I mean, I imagine every institution, Emory is not by any means special. Every institution probably has examples of this. And I think that one of the more dangerous things to do as a whistleblower is to suggest improprieties that might lead to a Medicare audit because of the severity of what that means for the institution. Our listeners may not realize it, but once an institution undergoes a Medicare audit, many, many other audits follow. You know, it's not just Medicare. And so that seems to be particularly not good for a whistleblower to do.
A whistleblower, you need to get legal advice on the best way to do this, because the fate of most whistleblowers is not good. As you
yeah.
But I think it's important, when there's true wrongdoing, to point it out and just do it in a way that you're as protected as possible. You know,
right.
Most large academic medical centers have 700 to 1,000 doctors on their staff, not to mention nurses, PAs, and others. And you can't have that many professionals and have good behavior by every single one of them.
Right.
So the question is not whether something's going to happen, is how do you detect it, and what do you do to prevent it, and what do you do to follow up on reports when they come from credible people. And that's the job of leadership.
Right. And in some institutions, there have been examples of people who are on, or doctors who are on the review committees, targeting other doctors who may practice a little different. And you know, people do have to understand that doctors do have different practice patterns, I would say. You know, some of my plastic surgery colleagues will operate on almost anything, and other ones will hardly operate on anything. You know, there's a bell curve of what people will do based on their competence and their ability and their training and their previous experience. So, you know, just because somebody does something differently doesn't mean it's done wrong. And in fact, I think that was used as some of the defense of the main character in your book, that he was just, you know, that there were practice differences, that I think one of the whistleblowers for many years was saying that was, that until he realized it really wasn't. It wasn't just practice differences. So, but in any case, some of the people with political power have tried to run doctors off staff that may be considered to be competition by basically false allegations against them. So that's the other side of it, that the people who want to, I guess, control economically their specialty in the hospital can present false things or blow things out of proportion to get these doctors terminated from the medical staff. And so these are the kind of things that I guess we need built-in controls for, so that people in positions of power, like the main character in your book, who is being protected by higher ups because of unrelated to patient care, and then versus the people in control and committees that are getting very good doctors kicked off of staff so that they don't have to worry about the competition. So I guess the question is, I know you've done, is your other book out yet?
Other book is out, yes.
And we want to mention its name and whether or not you're addressing some of these issues in that, or what you're addressing in your other book.
The other book is called What Every Doctor Should Know But Was Never Taught in Medical School. About 20 years ago, I got an MBA at Georgia State and realized how little practical advice trainees get, and this causes them to make mistakes sometimes in their choice of a practice and flounder around. So I wrote the book for other doctors to reduce the floundering aspect of things. So it's a book more for doctors about to enter practice or early in their practice years. There's advice in there for doctors at every level of practice, but the people who are going to get the most out of it is a resident or a fellow trying to figure out what to do with the rest of their life, and then once they're in practice, how to get established in a practice. So what every doctor should know but was never taught in medical school. Not necessarily something for the general public.
Sure.
Just want to give a present to your favorite doctor, which I will.
Right, that's right. Do you have any website or contact information you'd like to give right now?
Website is tomharbin.com, all together. And another website on the book that we're talking about today is wakingupblind.com.
Okay. And they can order the book there or, I guess, anywhere,
yeah,
right?
Or they're available from Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Barnes & Noble in Atlanta, anyway, and a couple of their stores have copies in stock.
Okay. Well, great. You had mentioned earlier that there may be a certain safer way to expose things that need to be exposed, whether it's within an institution like a hospital or within a university setting. You mentioned one thing is to have legal counsel, but what other advice would you give to, and it's not just doctors, but anybody who is observing a pattern of behavior and a pattern of practice that is not correct, maybe, like you said, nurses who might notice medical records being changed or any pattern that puts up a red flag. Is there a way that the two whistleblowers in your book could have done something better than what they did?
Well, if you're noticing, first of all, absolutely, if you see something going on that's wrong, you should speak up in the proper way. And this book documents the devastating things that happen to the institution eventually when it's ignored.
Mm-hmm.
But what you better hope for is that the leadership of your institution is amenable to hearing this.
Right, that's very true.
I think if you've got if you have an institution with a culture where they don't want to hear about problems, you're not going to have much of an audience, and your better bet may be to leave, as one doctor did.
Mm-hmm.
The dean and the CEO of New York University Medical Center wrote a blog about my book. This is an important, and a blog that goes out to all the people, all the doctors at NYU, and said, this is an important book, and I want you to understand that we don't want things like that happening here. So I emailed him back, and he said that they have a hotline that's anonymous and respected, And if they look into every complaint, even though they know some of the complaints are motivated by jealousy or anger.
Right, of course.
People making the complaint know that they will be protected, they won't be persecuted, and know that they'll get a report back.
Right.
And that type of leadership of an institution is what's absolutely essential. If you're lucky enough to be in such a place, then you'll have an audience and you can make your concerns known, probably, and know that they're going to be heard. But, you know, as I've given talks around, and we've kicked around, well, what if you don't have leadership like that? What happens? Well, unfortunately, if you don't have that culture, you're gonna be in trouble if you try to make valid complaints.
Yeah, I can tell you that I wrote a letter to the CEO of a prominent hospital here in Atlanta with about six instances of pretty serious patient care issues that involved nursing. I had failed to, handle it on the local level, so to speak. And within a few months, I was called in with a series of false allegations against me, including ridiculous ones that I had gone twice into surgery, put my hand on a patient's forehead while he or she was asleep on the table, told the anesthesiologist I healed them, and walked out. And in fact, it was all a series of allegations so ridiculous that the chief of surgery at the time didn't even go over all of them with me. But I would tell you that it's kind of important to know what you're accused of, because something years later occurred, and I found out, and it was very surprising to me the malice and viciousness of these accusations, which were brought primarily by the vice president of nursing, and so you just have to understand that I had no idea that my letter to the CEO would have done this. You know, this to me was unbelievable. But certainly, I thought the CEO would want to know about these problems. You know, they were very, very risky to the patient. But I think other doctors need to understand that sometimes when you write a letter with good intent and with, I wasn't trying to get anybody in trouble. I didn't even mention the names of the people, with the accents. I didn't even really go after anybody like the whistleblowers in your book were, had a particular target. I just wanted the CEO to know that he had problems in many, many areas involving nursing. So, but in any case, it's a lonely place to be a whistleblower sometimes.
Very lonely, but
it can be.
Not something that should be ignored.
Right.
No problem.
So do you have any future plans for, say, a more extensive book on medical ethics? It seems to me you've become a little bit of an expert in medical ethics to get through this.
You have read my mind.
Good.
My third book, which I just started and which will take a while. I mean, the first book took me 11 years.
Yeah?
Second book I wrote in the downtime of the first book, when I was waiting to hear back from various people about, editors waiting or lawyers or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But my third book is going to be Practical Ethics in Ophthalmology.
Great.
A lot of the ethics books are kind of pie in the sky and very theoretical and go back to philosophers and all that. But I think doctors need something, what do I do day to day and what are the issues that confront the practicing doctor? And so I want to write that and let that be a template and then have other doctors, such as other specialties, take my book and use the generic material for their specialty and add specific for their specialty. So there will eventually be a series of books, Practical Ethics in Plastic Surgery or Cardiology or on down the line. So that's my goal.
Well, that's great. That's very a very laudable goal. I don't know whether you research me very much, but I have written a book called The Naked Truth About Breast Implants. Certainly not endearing myself to my colleagues who believe the evening news rather than scientific research, and certainly not endearing myself to to the you know, the FDA or the implant companies. But in any case, I have a book in a chapter in my book about the ethical dilemma that plastic surgeons are in with this. Most of them choose simply not to really research it, so they don't really know what the toxicology literature and the, you know, they tell their patients that there is no problem with breast implants, that silicone is perfectly safe, and that you know, the study showed this. But in reality, that I think in 1996 there was a whole journal on toxicology just devoted to silicone toxicity. So, you know, so they can't really say that that was you know, say that with any degree of knowledge. And it's interesting how we are kind of guided through life. When I was a medical student at Washington University, my staff man, who Stephen Mathis, who's quite was a famous plastic surgeon, he's deceased now, asked me to write a review article on all of the complications of breast implants, which I did, and it was published. And I think that that was the beginning of my vast research into breast implants. And then I became sick myself when one of my implants, like just my left side, so all the symptoms were on the left side, and I started researching it, and I came out with all this medical and scientific literature showing what the problems were, including sick building syndrome, which is mold, you know, mold biotoxin disease, and chemical toxicity, and then particular silicone toxicity. As an ophthalmologist, you might be interested in two things that touch ophthalmology with silicone and saline. If, in fact, one of my patients was an ophthalmologist's wife, and she had a severe mold infection in her saline breast implant, and it was so severe that she had a decrease in her VEGF and ended up with a retinal detachment. So I wanted to, her husband wanted me to write a paper with him on this phenomenon because it was so interesting to him. But essentially, I would think all ophthalmologists should ask their female patients with retinal detachments that haven't had any trauma if they have breast implants, and they should also, you know, inquire if any of their patients are in moldy environments, because mold biotoxin disease, which has a genetic HLA component to it, so it doesn't affect 100% of the population, just about 25%, can end up leading to a retinal detachment. And then the other thing that's very, very interesting, because ophthalmologists use silicone in their the tear duct blocking little things are made of silicone. There are two HLA types that, when exposed to any silicone, even small amounts, can have autoimmune reactions, and that's HLA-DR53 and HLA-B27. So putting silicone in these patients for any specialty, and many of us use silicone, not just plastic surgery, they can end up with autoimmune diseases not linked to the silicone, and they can even die from that autoimmune disease. So these are things that are in the medical literature. They're not well known by doctors by any means, but doctors should know all of these things, because the rare patient that develops autoimmune disease after you use silicone in them, it's treatable if you remove the silicone. They get better.
Well, that's very interesting. And there are silicone lens implants that are not quite as common now as they used to be, and there's one of the treatments for very complicated retinal attachments is silicone oil.
Right. Yeah, I think the oil might be a problem. I was thinking about the lens implants a lot, and I kind of thought, and I'd like to get your opinion on this, that because they're not really they're not really connected with the immune system, they may not be a problem for people with this HLA type. I mean, do you agree that that might be protective?
Let's put it this way. There have been tons of them placed, and I'm unaware of any problems.
Right.
I think there would be somebody that's tumbling to this if indeed.
I do, too.
A problem, because there have just been so many, many people that have had silicone put in their eye for some.
Yeah, but silicone oil definitely, because I do believe that it could interact with the immune system in that location. Eventually, anyway, because oil tends to be hydrophobic, and can travel through cell membranes pretty easily. I mean, you know, it's not stopped by anything that we know of. And I think I've had patients who've had problems with the little silicone tubes that are placed in the area to prevent, so that tears will collect in the eye. That type of silicone actually does cause problems in some of my patients because they tend to be allergic to silicone as well. And even a silicone-based patch, like an estrogen patch, can cause a problem locally. And we commonly use Jackson Pratt drains, and they're made of silicone. And I have to keep the drain off the skin, or they'll blister within about 6 hours. So they're obviously very allergic to silicone. And I was too. I got a big blister. That's how I first discovered it, and then had to keep the silicone off the patient's skin. So you can become allergic to silicone, and if you're already allergic to silicone, especially with ruptured or leaking implants, dry eyes are almost always seen, and so they tend to be candidates for these little silicone plugs, and many a times they don't do well with them.
Not sure that's widely known, I'll have to say. I don't put a lot of, I specialize in glaucoma, so I don't
Right.
do that a lot in my own patients, so I'm not aware of any major set of problems. But
Since you specialize in glaucoma, could you, this question I had while reading your book, I just don't understand the reasons for this. The central character in your book changed. He crossed out the normal readings, which were gotten by machine, and put in his own readings and put FT, which means finger touch. Were all of those because either, number one, he wanted the pressures to be low enough so he could do the surgery, and then postoperatively he wanted to hide the fact they had glaucoma?
I think that's it. I mean, we trained together. He's a very intelligent man. People came to him and said, "You're missing glaucoma. They're going blind by the time they see me." And he simply wouldn't change. And I think it was he wanted better results on paper, and he wanted he didn't want to have to acknowledge a problem because then he would have to treat it, and it might take more time. And he was seeing not 90 people a day. He was seeing 150 people a day.
Do you think he truly believed that the postoperative glaucoma would get better on its own and not require treatment?
He knew better than that. You know, my lawyer has warned me not to venture into psychiatry and make pronouncements in public about this man, so I have to...
Okay. Well, I guess I'm just asking, like, because in general, and I know you know this, in general, when doctors do things, they have a reason, and the reason justifies their action. And I'm not trying, it's not so much a psychological thing, I'm just thinking that, well, if he thought that this postoperative glaucoma would go away on its own, he saw no harm in doing this.
I don't think he thought that.
Okay. Because, you know, you know very well from being in medicine a long time that doctors do things, but they are generally ethical enough that they have a reason for why they do them. You know, it's not. We're taught to think before we act, so you know we have reasons. But that was the thing that was amazing to me was that he would do these things thinking that this would never come back on him. I mean, it's obviously a cause and effect thing that if you cause something that is going to blind somebody and then you don't treat it, the person's going to end up blind. And like for me in plastic surgery, say if we do a facelift, I mean, one of the worst complications other than death, of course, could be that the whole flap dies, you know. And so in ophthalmology, I know that that's similar, that the worst complication you can have when you operate on an eye is that it goes blind. You know, you don't have too many deaths in ophthalmology, in other words. So he's really risking a lot by doing that.
There's no question about it.
I mean, I just want to emphasize to the listeners that it's not a minor thing. It's like, and it, if if people do go blind, I think that they will eventually trace it back to this person. I mean,
yes, but you know, there's some literature on people in power and what they end up thinking. And while I'm not making claims as to what this doctor was thinking, but there was an article about how these congressional staffers were using inside information to trade and buy stocks. And it said when you get to a position of power, you get to feel that you can do no wrong, number one. Number two, this is the first time I've heard this, that when you're in such a position, you have increased testosterone. And that mm-hmm. can make you more of the mindset that you can do no wrong and nothing bad will happen to you.
So risk-taking, yeah.
People in power where it's not rational, they just they think they're bulletproof.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure, I mean, as I was reading the book, I was trying to figure out why he would do something like that. It was like, you know, because it's so obvious that that's so dangerous. And, of course, it did. And the other thing I wanted to mention, I don't know how you feel about this, but were you surprised that there were only seven patients that sued?
Well, you know how a lot, you know, he's a very charming, articulate guy, and most people just loved him who were his patients.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how many people fully understood that they'd been wronged. There were certainly way more than seven that had bad results.
Yeah.
Maybe the word didn't get to them, or they just didn't feel like, you know, they wanted to go through the bother and all of that. So, seven lawsuits against one doctor is a tremendous amount of lawsuits, as you know.
It is, but given the number that appeared to be involved on the chart reviews, you know, it was not that many.
Yes, I agree.
Because this was more his normal pattern. It wasn't the exception.
I, you know, the lawyers aren't supposed to go out and solicit patients or clients.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe some of the lawyers who knew about problems just felt that their ethics prohibited them from going and getting more clients when they already
mm-hmm.
had a couple.
Yeah.
A lot of these people came from out of state or
yeah.
around the state, and so they weren't local, so they may not have been aware of the newspaper publicity that was here in Atlanta because they just
right.
went somewhere else.
So what were your feelings about how the newspaper reporter handled his end of it?
They did. I mean, they did not hold back.
Mm-hmm.
They reported a number of problems, and I quote Charles Seabrook, who was the reporter at the time, and he was very helpful to me and recounted the incident that I recalled about when he went out to Perimeter Mall, a mall near here, so, because some girl supposedly was going to give him some goods, and it turned out he figured out they were trying to pump him for information. But be that as it may, I asked him during the course of the interviews if he had been pressured by the higher-ups at the paper to not publish some of these things or to go slow or whatever, and he said
mm-hmm.
no.
Hmm.
That one competing thing for time in the medical front was this was when AIDS was coming up to the forefront.
Right.
And that took a lot of the newspaper's attention. And so, but he never felt any pressure not to write an article. And so I think the newspaper did fine, given the constraints of the newspaper.
Yeah, I wonder if in today's world that it would have been, you know, as free to write as it was then.
Well, I think it's free to write. I mean, you hear about medical problems and things like that.
Yeah. I guess it depends a lot. Well, with a newspaper, it may not be so constrained, but with other things, there's big money advertisers and, you know, I was talking with Lifetime the other day, and they were saying they'd have to run something by their advertisers because, you know, they didn't think their advertisers were making breast implants, but they had to make sure. So I know for sure that this is an issue.
That's sad.
It's what I heard from the, you know, from the.
As the reaction of your advertisers.
I think the vice producer of a program. So you know, he's not a minion. He's a, yeah. So I think primarily, and you know, well, I mean, the newspaper has advertisers too in print. You know, that could object to certain stories.
But Emory was not a big advertiser.
There you go. There you go. That must have been true.
A problem there.
Right.
I mean, they had influence in the community. So the question was, well, did the president of the university, who has friends all over the place, call and answer is that probably did not happen.
Well, that was probably smart of Emory not to wield that power too. You know, that probably might have come out as well, and that would look even worse for Emory. So you know, maybe it was smart just to stand back and let everything fall as it may. So.
I agree. Sometimes it's better to just take your lumps and then, and then let things pass.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're coming up to the end of our time. Is there any advice you'd like to give the listeners in terms of just in general? If you find yourself being in the position of being a whistleblower, no matter where you work.
I think there's some lessons of the book. One, for doctors in an organization, or really anybody in an organization,
right.
If there's something going on, you got to speak up in the correct way, because there's a huge cost to silence. If you're a leader, you need to have procedures in place so that people feel safe to report problems, and you need to follow up on them. Because if you ignore real problems, you might end up with a mess like this that costs you millions and millions of dollars, lost reputation, and lots of problems.
Mm-hmm.
Most of all, for patients, no matter who you see as a doctor, if they start going down a path that you've never heard of or that just doesn't sound right, get a second opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the patients who saw this doctor had never heard that they had corneal disease until they saw him.
Right.
They, in fact, did not have corneal disease. They just maybe had a cataract or something. So if they had, you know, they were snowed by seeing the chairman of the department, those are the best doctor in the state, so they just accepted what he said. But some of them should have had a little warning bell that said, nobody's ever mentioned this, and I've seen some pretty good people.
Right.
Let me check this out. So get a second opinion no matter what kind of doctor you're seeing if things don't add up. And those are the main lessons, I would say.
Yeah, people can also request copies of their medical records and their lab data. You might be surprised how often abnormal labs are not reported to the patient, especially abnormal MRI and CT findings. You know, like almost everybody has a little tiny lung nodule or a little tiny cyst in their liver, and a lot of times the doctors just don't mention it because it probably is nothing. But, you know, it's still good to tell the patient that they have it and you think it's nothing and not tell them anything, because then on the wrong side of the table, so to speak, they may think that you're covering that up, you know, when you really didn't. But from a patient's standpoint, you know, just getting a copy of your medical records and looking at them is a way to ensure that things aren't happening that are not that are not kosher. Especially, I'm not saying every doctor's visit, but you know, perhaps when you get a whole bunch of tests, you can ask for copies of the tests. Most doctors don't object to that at all, and it may be very important for you to look at the tests and see what's abnormal, what's not, to determine if your doctor's doing everything they're supposed to be doing when they look at your tests. You know, sometimes there's even something that's missed, you know. And
you have to take an active part in your own health.
Exactly. See, that could be your book after your third one.
That's a couple of years away, so we'll see what happens.
That's right. Well, thanks very much for joining us today. As I said, I really enjoyed your book. It was written like an author, not like an ophthalmologist. So you've got another career.
Right.
We've been interviewing Dr. Tom Harbin, Waking Up Blind, Lawsuits Over Eye Surgery. Again, this addresses great broad ethical concerns, whistleblower advice, and things that is what they used to say, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And it's a great book, and I encourage you all to read it. Next week, we're going to have Dr. Pam Weibel, who is one of my co-authors in Goddess Shift. We'll be interviewing her, and then on the 26th, Ivan Rados is back with Transform Your Life Through Sacred Geometry. And then on the 5th of March, Dr. Michael Gershon, The Second Brain, A Groundbreaking New Understanding of Nervous Disorders of the Stomach and Intestine. We also have Noetic Science the third Thursday of every month. Gina Jones will be presenting Your Life of Destiny, Past, Present, and Future. And Dr. Charles Skillis will be the presenter in March on hypnotherapy technology in his book, Defeat the Enemy Within. Thank you very much for joining us today. I do have one more announcement on the One Pass Summit. This is on March 26th and 27th at the Atlanta George Cobb Galleria. This is a unique opportunity to participate with doctors that are creating the future of healthcare at the One Pass Summit. Lectures and public forums that bridge traditional and integrative medical practice to educate you about your healthcare options. Learn more about this and register at onepathsummit.com. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Harbin. I appreciate you taking some time on Saturday to talk with us about your book.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. We'll be back next week with Temple of Health Radio Show.
I'll talk to you later.
Thank you.